the official Coast Guard song sends us into our first segment today. It's titled Semper Paratus, which is Latin for always ready. And I think that's pretty appropriate as we talk about the U.S. Coast Guard. It operates in all 50 states, has a district dedicated to the entirety of the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we talk about the Coast Guard's mission to protect boaters, enforce the laws on our largest inland seas with our guest, Lieutenant Phil Gertler. He is a public affairs officer with the 9th Coast Guard District External Affairs Division based at the Command Center in Cleveland, Ohio. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What are your thoughts about serving in the Coast Guard? In addition to its peacetime duties, how does it support combat missions involving the U.S. Navy? Maybe you have experienced something that has involved the Coast Guard. Maybe you were once a member. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Lieutenant Philip Gertler, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me be involved in this. As a Wisconsin native, I've spent a couple of summers working the farm listening to WPR, so I'm real happy to be involved and kind of giving back to it.
Well, thanks so much, Phil. Let's do a big picture first, kind of. What's the mission of the U.S. Coast Guard?
So the mission of the U.S. Coast Guard is we're very unique in what we do. We're kind of military, we're kind of law enforcement, we're a lot of humanitarian, but it really stems from, really since the founding of the United States, and in 1790, the founding of the Revenue Cutter Service, and that's really where we go back to as kind of our birth, and that is, frankly, making sure that we're enforcing tariffs, doing things like that on the coasts. But as technology progresses, as culture progresses, lighthouses become a thing, steamboats become a thing, and there are these smaller organizations that are created federally, Steamboat Inspection Service, Lighthouse Service, Life-Saving Service, and it just kind of made sense in 1915 to put them together into one organization, the U.S. Coast Guard. So our missions range from, you know, we assist Customs and Border Patrol, we guard the coast itself, but we also do aids to navigation. That's stemming from the lighthouses of, you know, buoys, day markers, things like that, making sure that really the waterways of the United States are safe. But we also have law enforcement, migrant interdiction. We, as an organization, we have a lot of hats. But we're really happy that we have those capabilities to go out and do those missions. Yep. And then the big one that everyone thinks about, obviously, is, especially in the Great Lakes, is search and rescue.
Which you do a lot of, apparently. And, you know, somebody might, and we can talk about that as we move along today, but somebody might ask, well, what's the difference between the Coast Guard and our Navy?
One, want to make it perfectly clear that we are the longest continuing service, or continuously serving seagoing service. The Navy was abolished for a couple of years. So nothing against the Navy, but just want to throw that out there. But a lot of that difference really does kind of boil down to we are more paramilitary, whereas the Navy is a military branch. There's a couple of cool things that come along with that. We are Department of Homeland Security versus Department of Defense. And really it is more of that Homeland Security mission, national security mission. We do have Coast Guard members that are forward deployed on Navy vessels. We call them LEDETs or law enforcement detachments because there are certain things that a Coast Guard cutter can do for law enforcement than that a Navy vessel may not be able to. So having those detachments on board, they will lead that law enforcement party and it will actually be a Coast Guard mission in support of the Navy. But we also do have, you know, some of our deployable special operations units. Coast Guard specialty really is more of the shallow water. My sister was actually deployed to Bahrain, where she assisted with protection of some of the different oil platforms out there, because there's a lot of nations out there that, you know, they want to have the capability of protecting their borders, but having a full-fledged Navy just doesn't make sense for them. So we work with a lot of these international partners to help establish and run their Coast Guard, which gives them the capabilities they're looking for without having to, you know, have a full blue water Navy.
Phil, you mentioned your sister, and it got me thinking, all right, this is almost like a family affair here. How did you get in? How did you get involved? It was, you know, does this go back before your time within your family?
My sister and I are actually the first two since the Civil War in my family to serve. But as for what really got me into it, probably too much Captain America as a kid. I'd wanted to serve, but really it was the Coast Guard's mission, that humanitarian side, kind of more of the shield versus the sword, that really drew me to it.
Yeah, I can see why. The 9th District. How big is the 9th Coast Guard District?
So the 9th Coast Guard District is, well, just talking a little bit about the Great Lakes, it's 21% of the world's fresh water. There's more than 34 million people that live in the Great Lake Basin. It is 8 U.S. states, 2 Canadian provinces, 42 different tribal nations, and, you know, you can't count the number of local governments that are in those areas as well. The Great Lakes are huge. It is one of our Coast Guard districts. So you go sector, we have 4 sectors that are covering each one of the individual lakes. Then you have district, which is covering all of those together. And then the next step up is all of land area, basically cut the U.S. in half, the land area and PAC area, Pacific area.
That's a lot of area.
Yeah.
So the number of people, you must have a fair number of people operating on this. Let's zero in maybe a bit on Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, because that's what's bordering our state.
Mm-hmm. So we are, as a Coast Guard as a whole, we're about 30 to 40,000 people, you know, fluctuates. When it comes down to specifically sector Lake Michigan, you know, we have 7 small boat stations that dot the lake going all the way around. We have 2 aids to navigation teams. These are the ones their specialty is, you know, buoys, things like that. And then we have 3 units that their specialty is more the pollution response. But there can't be more than 1,000 folks all around Lake Michigan. We're a bit of a small service. We do a lot with what we have, but that's kind of always been what we're known for. So we that's something we take pride in, is being as efficient as possible.
Yeah. Well, I know the 9th Coast Guard District's Lake Michigan sector operates out of Milwaukee primarily. What kinds of situations does the sector handle?
So the sector is, like I said, it covers the entirety of the lake.
Yeah.
And that is really the control center for the lake. So it's operational, but also a lot of the logistical sides of things. So we have facility engineers that are there. We have logistic folks, the YN, the yeomans, who are our paperwork folks, our storekeepers, the ones who do the purchasing. So anything that you can really think of logistically, they're going to support there. Operationally, that is where Lake Michigan's primary command center is. And what is in the command center is, it's a lot of folks, their specialties, they're called operational specialists. And their whole career path, all of their training is, how do I take information from a caller? You know, think of it kind of as a dispatch. I'm getting either a call on the radio, I'm getting a call directly from somebody who's on a boat that's sinking, I'm getting a call from 911 because, you know, that's the number that people call right away when they're in trouble. And they can take that information. We've got a couple of really cool computer programs that let us generate a search area, you know, probabilities. Where is it going to be the best chance to search when we send out our assets? What assets are available? And then they can take that information and they say, you know, there is a case that is off of, you know, Navy Pier down in Chicago. Okay, Station Chicago is going to be the best asset. And then they work with that small boat station to actually affect the rescue.
Wow. There's a lot that's going on there.
Yes.
Out of Milwaukee, give me some numbers for, if you can, search and rescue cases, law enforcement boardings every year. What have you got?
So for total number of cases out just in Lake Michigan last year, we had 1,023. So that is search and rescue, law enforcement, pollution, things of that nature. Specifically for search and rescue, they had 597 search and rescue cases.
Wow.
And in those 500, so just shy of 600, they assisted 730 people, which assisted can mean something as simple as we got a report, we came out there, they ran out of gas, we sat with them until they were able to get towed or whatever it is. But we had 329 lives saved. And what that metric is that specifically is if but for direct Coast Guard intervention, highly likely that that individual would not have survived.
Wow.
So Coast Guard units saved 329 lives last year just in Lake Michigan.
So it's practically one life a day.
Just about. D9 is kind of an interesting situation. We are usually number two or number three for search and rescue cases in the Coast Guard by all the districts. However, our boating season, as you know, is incredibly short. So we are getting, you know, equal number of cases as East Coast, West Coast, but we're doing it in 3 months versus 12.
Oh, man. You got to be on your toes and ready to go. There are lots more I want to talk with you about today, Phil. And we'll let our listeners join in. Do you have a question or a comment, or maybe you've been involved in one of these search and rescue operations yourself? I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Great to have you with us as we talk about the Coast Guard. I want to just mention our June member drive is quickly approaching. We have a special challenge to meet that goal. You can be one of 500 people who donate before the 27th of June, and a generous group of members are going to add an additional $10,000 for WPR programs. You can join in now at WPR.org/donate. Become one of those first 500. That's WPR.org/donate. Love to hear from you for that. And love to hear from you with questions about the Coast Guard or maybe an experience to share. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I was reading online, Phil, and there was a little story about this past Memorial Day where the Coast Guard at the Lake Michigan Command Center in Milwaukee helped rescue a guy who was stuck on a sinking sailboat. And that was that a typical? I think that involved a helicopter.
Yes, it did. That's a very typical phone call that we get is, you know, Mayday, Mayday, my vessel's going down. And again, those folks in the command center, they take that information, they figure out, okay, the call came from this area, they can triangulate some of that information, and then they'll work with the air stations who respond to this, and then also the small boat stations to get out there as quickly as possible to effect the rescue. But that, as for, that is very much a routine call that we get.
Oh man, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, you pulled him out just before the boat sank.
Yes, that is something that does come up occasionally. Is, you know, we are very much rescue the people. If the vessel has to go down, it's people first. Weirdly enough, we actually see this the most with ice rescue, where some city will, almost every year we have a call of, you know, there's a big ice fishing tournament and somebody looks up from their hole and sees that the shoreline is moving away from them. I think last year we pulled 60 people off of one ice floe. And you go out there and you rescue them and they're super happy, but it's what about my ice shack? Well, we are here to rescue you.
Can you airlift my ice shack?
Yeah.
I'll sit in it while you do it. Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, you're going to avoid. Let's take the sailboat. If you're going to avoid life-saving situations like this, and by the way, I don't know, you have probably swam in Lake Michigan. I've dipped my toes in there, too, and it's cold. And you're not going to last very long.
No, and that's one of the biggest things that we run into is it's twofold. One, people look at the weather and they say it's 70 degrees out. That's an awesome day to be at, you know, out on the water, not realizing that early summer, you know, while that water could still be 40, 45 degrees cold. That's cold.
Yes.
And that can actually put you in a dangerous situation. But on the reverse side of that, there are people, unfortunately, that seem to think, oh, you know, hypothermia is going to, that's what's going to kill me right away. So they're not wearing life jackets. But we're finding that wearing a life jacket that's properly fitted, that it's a Coast Guard approved life jacket, really is one of the biggest determining factors. If you find yourself in a situation like this, where you're in the water, that's going to keep you alive long enough for us to come out and get to you.
Yeah, and that Coast Guard approved, you know, I've always looked for that Coast Guard approval stamp or whatever on any flotation device that I've ever purchased. How do you have any idea of the kind of process you go through for something like that to get a Coast Guard approval?
We work very closely with some of our different partners in the industries. You know, if I'm a life jacket manufacturer, I know that if I don't get that Coast Guard approval, my life jackets aren't going to sell. So there's a real good working relationship between a lot of those commercial entities and the Coast Guard to make sure that they're meeting the standards. One of the big things is making sure that it's properly fitted, making sure that it's made out of the right materials. So as for how that process actually looks like, no idea. We have an entire legal department that is responsible for that, and God bless them.
Oh, man.
Thank you.
Sort of like the good housekeeping seal of approval, you know? To see that Coast Guard approved, you know it's going to be okay. Jeff in McFarland has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. So this is a short sea story from back in about 78. I was in the Coast Guard on a 180-foot buoy tender icebreaker out of Sturgeon Bay. It was the Acacia. And, you know, our mission normally was to, as he described earlier, to take care of buoys, pull them out for the winter and put them back in the spring and ice break. But we got a call, I think it was October. It was really getting cold and we had about 10-foot seas. We were in northern Lake Michigan. We got a call of a pleasure craft going down. And I bring this up because it just gives an example of some of the Coast Guard assets. So it was a family about four, and they were sinking their seal along their prop shaft was leaking, and they had cognitively impaired child on there, and one person was seasick. And so myself and another lieutenant, junior grade, put on the wetsuits, jumped over, swam over, and then the helicopter out of Traverse City lowered down. This is It was just getting dark, lowered down. It was called a P250 pump. You could pump 250 gallons a minute. And got that going and got them dewatered, then got them towed in, and it worked out fine. But just an example of the coordination of, you know, normally 180-foot ship like that, we wouldn't do rescues with the public if it was a commercial vessel in trouble. But we were the one asset that could reach these folks before they went down, and it worked out. So just an example of mixing the Coast Guard assets.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for your service on that. Comment on that, Phil?
That sounds very plausible. A lot of times, especially in those, you know, those crappier weather conditions, that's one of the things like the Command Center of Milwaukee takes into account is, you know, which asset can do it safely. And a lot of times, if it is kind of, you know, the weather's uglier like that, we will reach out to one of our Coast Guard cutters. We have 10 of them here in the lake. I've just got a list of them here. You said it was up. He said it was up in Sturgeon Bay. We've got the U.S. Coast Guard Mobile Bay. Actually, a classmate of mine was out on that, and it is very common for, I know you're doing buoy work right now, search and rescue case kind of takes priority. We're going to have to task you to help with that.
I got it. Jeff, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. And I got a question for your guest. I see people building boats, and I always wonder before I get on them, has anyone determined what the capacity is? How many people can they take on board? What size of a motor can they put on it? Does the Coast Guard help with that at all?
So the Coast Guard helps with that in the sense that, you know, safety of the public, people out on the water, safety of the waterways is our mission. If you want to go out there and build your own vessel, love the American spirit. I love it. We do offer safety inspections. A lot of times we have an organization called the Coast Guard Auxiliary, who is, first off, is an amazing organization. Everybody that's part of it is amazing because these are people who volunteer their time to go out there, help assist the Coast Guard. And one of the things that they do are those inspections. There are a whole list of regulations based on the size of your vessel, you know, what kind of communication equipment do you have? What kind of lights do you have to have? And that is something that when a Coast Guard does a safety boarding, now you're out there on the water on 4th of July and the Coast Guard boards you, it really is, it's a safety inspection. And that's when we go in and enforce, you know, those safety regulations. But a lot of times reaching out to the auxiliary beforehand, setting up a meeting with them, they will go through and they will check to make sure that your vessel is in compliance with those rules.
Very interesting. Tom, thank you so much for calling. Excuse me. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Before we go back to the phones, I know the Coast Guard gets involved in pollution cases. You mentioned that. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. So the Coast Guard, as part of maintaining the waterways, maintaining natural resources, we work very closely with our state partners. We work very closely with EPA, depending on where it is, what the case is. We are intimately involved in the pollution aspects. For Lake Michigan specifically, we're thinking about, you know, if one of the Lakers starts spilling oil or something as simple as, you know, that sailboat that went down. Okay, we pulled all the people off of the sailboat. Priority number one, we've saved everybody's life. Okay, now we're looking at, you know, it's got 10 gallons of fuel on it. It's got, if it's a larger vessel, it's got 150 gallons of fuel on it. That's something that once the immediate search and rescue aspect is taken away from a case, we're instantly looking at, you know, what is the environmental impacts? Is it down by the Indiana Dunes? Are there any endangered species that are in the area? Piping plover is the one that, you know, the world shuts down for piping plover. But, you know, what is the environmental impact to the area? How best can we mitigate it? And how can we set up for cleanup should worst case scenario happen?
I think Paul in Madison has something that relates to this. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Larry. Are the environmental projects primarily maritime based? I mean, that would, you know, be caused by a boat, or do you deal with things that happen on the shore as well?
Thank you for that question. That's a great one. Like I said, we work a lot of times with EPA, but most of the cases that we do deal with are maritime associated. That being said, when I was in Milwaukee as a response officer, part of that is pollution response. And it was Kenosha, and it was an oil spill that actually happened, I think it was like a mile inland. I think it was a gas station or something. But it got into the storm drain. Storm drain fed into the lake. So that was, you know, part of our investigation is, okay, we see the sheen on Lake Michigan. It was actually next to a marina. So we're thinking, you know, is it a vessel that's having this? Looked at it. No, we were able to determine, you know, where it was coming from. Came from a storm drain. And then we actually worked with the city to backtrack that. They've got some folks that can track, you know, where it actually came from. Ended up being from a business downtown, actually. So it really is. It's not so much where it comes from as where it happens.
Very interesting. Maggie and Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. Yeah, Lieutenant, I thought you might get a kick out of this story. My dad grew up on a small dairy farm in Forest County. And before World War II, he wanted to enlist, or actually at the start of it, in the Army Air, well, actually in the Coast Guard. He went down to Chicago, couldn't find the Coast Guard station, so he ended up in the Army Air Corps instead. And, you know, he thought Coast Guard, I'd always have a nice duty station because I'd be on water. And I just thought you might get a kick out of that story since you listened to public radio while you were on a farm. So thank you for your service.
Maggie, thanks very much for calling. Well, there's a good story for you, Phil.
No, I wanted to say thank you very much for sharing that. Rhinelander was, I'm hoping the cheese factory's still there. I haven't been back to Rhinelander in a couple of years. But, yep, grew up on Granddad's dairy farm in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So, and that story's pretty typical, and that's part of the reason why a lot of people choose the Coast Guard is, you know, where are you being stationed? It's New York City is our largest small boat station. You're on the coast. Typically, wherever you're being stationed is, it's pretty nice.
What kind of training, though, do you go through? I expect it's a military kind of thing. So I expect you got maybe a sort of a military kind of education before you can join.
Yes. So we have a couple of different primary ways to get in. Speaking personally from my personal experience, I went to the Coast Guard Academy. It's in New London, Connecticut, and it's basically our version of West Point. So you go through a period of basic training at the start of it. So you go through a 7-week basic training period, and then you have 4 years of college education interspaced with going out to actual Coast Guard units during your summers. So you don't even get summers off. You're going off and doing more training. As for the enlisted side, we do have an 8-week basic training program that's in New Jersey, Cape May, beautiful area. That was one of my summers, actually, was I was stationed at the small boat station on the training base. But it's, you know, a typical basic, it is a military basic training. There are, you know, regular military indoctrination. You also have, we are a paramilitary organization. We're a law enforcement agency. Part of that is firearms training on our standard issue PD personal defense weapons. But it's also kind of, we're being a nautical service. It is the basics of seamanship as well.
Yeah. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, when I was in grade school in the early 60s, the parochial school, we were asked, you know, about the government, and a lot of people thought the Coast Guard was under the Defense Department, but back then it was still under the Treasury Department. The reason, they were supposed to prevent smuggling into the U.S.
Yeah, that you want to give us a little of that history, Phil?
Sure. And he's exactly right. When I was saying the revenue cutter service, it's what is smuggling but an attempt to bring something into the country illegally, avoiding those tariffs. That really was the foundation of the Revenue Cutter Service, which morphed into the Coast Guard. We were under the Department of Treasury, Department of Transportation for a while. Post 9/11 is with the creation of Department of Homeland Security is when we changed into, as it was created, we morphed into that. As for being part of the Department of Defense, we do occasionally in times of war, we will get foldered into the Department of the Navy, and that's just because we are very similar, but we do bring a specific training, mentality, and skill set that the Navy may otherwise not. A lot of the Marine landings in World War II actually were my Coast Guard crews, actually, because, you know, yes, the Navy's really good at driving destroyers out in deep water where they can't run into anything, run aground. Coast Guard, you know, we're a little bit more used to operating in shallow waters. Another one that comes to mind is helicopter pilot rescue during the Vietnam War, actually. Jolly Green Giants is what they were called, where, you know, an Allied fighter pilot would go down, and the Coast Guard were actually the ones pulling them out with the helicopter because they were the ones search and rescue. How do they affect helicopter rescue without actually landing and going through all that process with, you know, that's something we do every day with our rescue swimmers.
Really interesting. Tom from McQuantico emailed to share that his father was in the Coast Guard during World War II. After the war, he used the GI Bill and ROTC to be commissioned in the Army. In college, he met Tom's mother, built a house in Marblehead, Ohio, right behind the Coast Guard station there. Tom says he heard that the station on Lake Erie is the busiest station in the U.S. Is that accurate?
I have, without going in and actually looking at some of those specific numbers for that station, can't say. But like I said, we are one of the busiest districts, but we do it in 3 months. So that would not terribly surprise me if it is one of the most busiest.
I would bet, especially in the summer months, you're the busiest for sure.
Yes.
You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like Tom, you could email us. Email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. The Lake Michigan Command Center in Milwaukee oversees about 350 law enforcement boardings of boats per year. Typically, what prompts officers to want to search a private vessel?
Sure. So a lot of times we will go off, we will do an inspection like that. That is more so tied to the safety. We'll go in, like I said, there's a whole list of regulations, you know, number of fire extinguishers you have to have, sound signal capabilities, things like that. And that is kind of what most of those inspections are. That being said, we do get quite a few calls of, hey, I'm sitting just outside the marina. I see another vessel that is, you know, it's waking everybody out. I see the driver actively drinking at the wheel. And we'll respond to those cases. There was one in the lock of Chicago. So, you know, we're sitting there with all these different boats. They're raising the water to match it. And a pontoon next to us was having a party, and we watched the driver, you know, down three shots while sitting there. Yeah, we pulled him over. He didn't even make it out of the lock.
Oh, man. Olivia in Dubuque, Iowa. We go to you now. Hi, Olivia.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My husband and I lived in Southeast Alaska for approximately 18 years in both Indian communities as well as in the capital city, Juneau. And we had a lot of experience with Coast Guard people. We have never been personally rescued, but we knew people who were. I do have an interesting story about Coast Guardmen stationed on lighthouse stations. Back in the 60s, they had a one of Five Finger Lighthouse was a manned Coast Guard station. It wasn't automated yet, manned. And there are five Coast Guardmen stationed on this lighthouse for 1 year. And they could get off and go fishing within a mile of the lighthouse. But they couldn't leave unless they got sick and had to be flown to Juneau for medical. So they were there 1 year. We were going by to visit one time, and we got a call from them. Their supply boat forgot to bring cigarettes, and they were out of cigarettes on this lighthouse station. They were desperate. And so we had a group that was going to stop by there and do a singing performance for them. And they said, bring cigarettes. So we got cigarettes, and we had a Christian youth group was coming to sing to them. And they, when they got the boat up to the stairway up to the lighthouse, they said, did you bring the cigarettes? And we said, yes. And so anyway, the kids got up. There were about 25 in the group. There were five Coast Guardmen. They got their cigarettes. They put five chairs out, and this group sang to them. And then we left and went on our way. So it was fun.
Probably don't get those kind of requests anymore, Phil.
We get a lot of odd requests, but nothing quite like that. I'm sure that was a performance that they will never forget. I was stationed up in Kodiak, Alaska for my first tour, actually, and Juneau, beautiful area pulling in. That really is, it's very interesting to see how different the mission set up there is than D9 here in the Great Lakes, but it's all the same. We're all trained to that same standard. So we'll pull people from around the country. And yeah, the mission's a little bit different, but because they go through that training process, the training process is the same for everybody. We can pull people from different responses or for different things, put them into the case, and they can perform wonderfully.
Olivia, thank you so much for calling. We're visiting today, having a really good time talking with Lieutenant Philip Gertler. He's the public affairs officer for the 9th U.S. Coast Guard District, responsible for all Coast Guard operations on and surrounding the Great Lakes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the Coast Guard and its operations, especially in Lake Michigan and Superior, but the Coast Guard, the 9th District, operates in all of our Great Lakes. So it's great to have our guest, Lieutenant Philip Gertler, with us. He's the public affairs officer in the 9th U.S. Coast Guard District. Great to have him with us. You can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Jane in Manitowoc next. Hi, Jane.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for another great show. Philip, first I want to thank you for your service. And as a retired Army and retired County Veteran Service Officer, please encourage your members to check out their VA benefits. I had Coast Guard guys come in the office that would go, well, I'm not sure I'm eligible for VA. And it's like, yes, you are. You serve this nation, especially if you have any injuries or illnesses due to exposures in service. So please encourage them to reach out to the County Veteran Service Office. Thank you so much for your time. And again, thank you for your service.
Thank you, Jane. Comment on that, Philip?
One, thank you very much for that. Really appreciate the support of you and our county veteran affairs offices. That is one thing that a lot of people, Coast Guard, oh, that's not military. No, we still are part of the military. We are entitled to those benefits. And it's interesting, one thing that I love about D9 is how intertwined we are with the community. So Lake Michigan specifically, we've got Grand Haven Festival. Grand Haven is the Coast Guard city every year. They hold a huge festival for us. We really appreciate it. We get the cutters out there. We get some of the helicopters out there, and it's really a great time. Sturgeon Bay is also a Coast Guard city. We actually just were renewing their certification as a Coast Guard city. So the support of the communities is really what allows us to be as effective as we are, and we couldn't do it without that support.
And I'm sure, well, I hope at least, that the Coast Guard is reminding its members about the benefits, as Jane was talking about. The eligibility for benefits is very important.
Yes, that is. Actually, every member, when they leave the service, there is a class that they have to go through. It is required before you leave the service, and that is one of the things that they spend a couple of days covering is, you know, how does that process look? Where do you get it from?
Brian in Madison was curious about whether the Coast Guard deals with piracy or robbery of boats on the Great Lakes.
So fortunately, knock on wood here, that is one of those missions that we do a little bit. We really don't have too much here in the Great Lakes for. However, the beauty of the Coast Guard is if you join and that's something you want to go out there and fight piracy, we have units that's primarily what they do. So a lot of the patrols that come out of, you know, the Gulf of Mexico down south like that, that is one of their primary missions. But D9, fortunately, like I said, knock on wood,
yeah,
that's a little bit smaller. We deal with a lot less of those.
That's a good thing. Let's go to Aaron in Oshkosh next. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Thank you so much for taking my phone call. I mean this in the truest, most genuine nature, but this is kind of like the X-Files, Fox Mulder thing. Being as District 9 deals with all of the Great Lakes, it's a two-part question, please. What is the strangest call that our individual here has ever had to respond to or is aware of, and have they ever responded or are they aware of anything having to do with like a lake monster? Think of Nelly, you know, for instance, because I've lived on a couple of the Great Lakes and I actually have a couple of very interesting stories that I personally have been witness to, and I would love to hear the response, and thank you so much.
All right, Aaron, thank you. So two-part question there, Philip.
All right. So I'm going to start with the second question. To my knowledge, I'm absolutely positive that somewhere there's been a report of, you know, Nessie or something of that like, but I've never seen or heard of one. I did have one of my ETs request an exorcism for a machine one time. That's about as close to monsters as I've ever seen. As for the weirdest case that call that I ever got was a gentleman, can talk very broadly here, going through a divorce. His wife, his then ex-wife, got the boat. He tried to go out and sink the boat to spite her. You know, we pulled up onto it. Fortunately, it was a cork-filled boat, so even if you know, drilling holes in it, it wasn't sinking. So we talk about what gets you, you know, what causes a Coast Guard crew to come over and do a safety inspection. You're sitting there with a drill poking holes in your own boat. Yeah, we're gonna chat with you.
Oh boy!
So that was,
and he didn't realize it would sink even if he poked holes in it.
Yes. So he got. We pulled up. No, you can't just sink your boat anywhere. You have to, if you want to get rid of it, you got to properly dispose of it. Again, some of that pollution concerns. You know, if you sink it in a channel, there's major concerns with that. So they towed him in. It was a whole thing, and then there was the wife's lawyer was trying to prove that he was destroying the property. A whole mess. But yes, do not try to sink your boat off of a beach. Thank you.
Is there any requirement? I know in some lakes, for example, I know someone whose car was driving his car out on the lake. And the ice broke, and the lake went to the bottom, and he was required to get that boat or that car out of the lake, which was a very expensive little process involving scuba divers and, you know, winter and so forth. Is there anything law like that regarding, you know, something, you drop your boat and your boat sinks in Lake Michigan, are you responsible for anything in terms of getting it out or costs associated?
You know, every case is going to, it very much is a case-by-case basis, but it does, you know, what constitutes a pollution incident for us, it's basically one drop of oil. It's anything that causes a sheen. And I don't know if you've ever dropped a drop of oil, but it goes out there. But it really is kind of a case-by-case basis. You know, is it intentional? Are they trying to get it out? But yes, strictly speaking, there is a duty. We call it whenever there's a pollution case like this, we call it the responsible party to rectify the situation. That could be something of, you know, the vessel sank in the middle of the lake. You know, is it possible to recover it? Two, if we go in and it's, you know, it's deep enough where it's not going to cause an issue to other boats, you know, a danger, do you just go in and you have to recover the, you know, remove the pollution? Is that enough? That's when I say that we've got those units that that's their specialty is, you know, this is what happened. This is what the situation we're looking at. What are the options going forward?
Yeah. Well, like that guy we were talking about earlier with his sailboat, I mean, that sailboat went down in 300 feet of water.
Mm-hmm. And a small sailboat like that, it's not going to have a huge internal fuel tank. You know, it's a case-by-case basis. I'm not sure the status of that one, but,
yeah,
you know, you can only do what you can do.
I got to believe the 4th of July weekend is a busy time. And what do you have for it? You know, when people like to be out on the water and you have a boating safety division, what preventive measures do you have for promoting a way to reduce loss of injuries and life from boating on the Great Lakes?
Biggest thing is, you know, boat responsibly. A lot of people, they don't realize that, you know, if you are operating a boat under the influence, that is a crime, both state and federally. We will come after you. We will find you, and we'll come after you, and we'll arrest you potentially for it. But while boating under the influence, and life jackets. You know, technically you're supposed to have a life jacket for every person on board. You know, if the boat sinks and it splits in half and there's a disaster, yeah, it's great you had the life jacket, you know, stowed in the compartment down below, locked, and you forgot it was there. Really, wearing the life jackets, no, it's not. We totally understand that it's not fashionable, but that is really what's going to keep you alive until help can get to you. And then thirdly, how does help get to you? Well, we have to know that there's an incident, whether that's cell phones, which may be limited in range once you start getting further outside of shore. Primary is going to be channel 16 on VHF radio. We have folks at those command centers that are monitoring channel 16 24/7. And we have the capability of, you know, somebody jumps on there and says, Mayday, we can actually triangulate that position. And that is a huge help for us because we know, okay, they made a call at this time. They're here. They're somewhere in this vicinity.
Yeah.
So those are really three big things is, no alcohol, drugs while driving a boat, wearing your life jacket, communication.
Lieutenant Philip Girdler, you do a great job. Thank you so much for your service and for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Like I said, I'm happy to be able to give back to WPR after all the good that they've done for Wisconsin and myself personally.
Phil, thank you so much. Philip Girdler, Lieutenant, Public Affairs Officer for the 9th U.S. Coast Guard District, responsible for all Coast Guard operations on and surrounding the Great Lakes. I learned a lot. I hope you did, too. Coming up next, we'll take a look at weather and climate with our weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, we've had some above-average rainfall this month here in Wisconsin, and, of course, this past weekend we had many tornadoes. There were six of them five EF1s and one EF2 tornado that I think covered five counties in the state were involved in that. We're going to talk a little bit about tornadoes, among other things, with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. It's great to have both of them back. And if you have a question or maybe an experience about tornadoes or other weather events, you are most welcome to join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Steve, good to see your smiling face.
It's good to be smiling, as usual. Yeah.
John, you're smiling too, John
I feel
Martin.
Great, Larry. I couldn't feel better.
Well, I tell
beautiful
you what.
Beautiful weather out there today. Dave, yeah, in southern Wisconsin.
You know, lots we can talk about. I wanted to also get into hurricane season. There's a lot of things that we can discuss today on the show. And again, you can join us with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Well, EF1, EF2, EF3, whatever the numbers may be, maybe you can talk a little bit about what is an EF1, what is an EF2, and so forth.
Yeah, that's the Enhanced Fujita Scale. So Professor Ted Fujita from the University of Chicago was interested in tornadoes in the 50s and 60s, was kind of the height of his career. And he realized you could only estimate their intensity after the fact, because nobody has a wind gauge that's going to, you know, survive a close call with a tornado, so there's not going to be any direct data on that. And so the scale is based upon his estimation of intensity, which was in turn based upon how much damage a particular storm would do. So an EF1, I think, can take trees down. EF2, it graduates in such a way. And by the time you get to EF5, you leave not a trace of a building is left, not even the foundation. And so that's how the scale works, dependent on damage surveys. So actually, we were saying before the show started that, you know, when you gave us the stats on the number of EF1s and the one EF2, they may well be revised. I think the Weather Service goes out and tries to make an initial estimate using this exact scale, damage scale. And then they may say, you know, we didn't see all of this stuff in the vicinity. We may upgrade or downgrade one of those decisions.
Well, yeah, that was supposedly, at least at first, estimated to be an EF1 that took that 129-year-old Apple Grove Lutheran Church completely destroyed.
It's amazing, the pictures I saw of that, yeah.
Yeah, and we were wondering what would they classify that as, considering right. The destruction was total. But there was nothing, seemed like, in the area that was hit. Usually you'll see the path of the tornado ripping up grass or things like that.
Right. I didn't see that in that one picture in the newspaper. And then the other is it probably was a timber-only structure. I bet there was no reinforced steel or anything because it's 129 years old. So there's a couple of things going in both directions on that. Should it be a stronger tornado or could a weaker one have done that?
Fawn in Madison has a question that relates to this, and I experienced what she's going to talk about. Let's, Fawn, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have this burning question. I must know the answer to this. On Saturday evening, when the storms are rolling in, I live on the east side of Madison. There's a period of time between 7, I think it started about 10 after 7, and it went on for 20, 30, maybe almost 40 minutes. I didn't time it. A continuous roll of thunder. Continuous low rumble of thunder. I've never experienced anything like it.
I'm with you, Fawn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. I live over on the east side of Madison, too, and I was just amazed at that continuous roll.
Yeah, I had friends on the west side we visited with yesterday morning, gave me the same story. And my guess was that I had looked at the radar when the thing came in, and it was a pretty intense little line, maybe stretched 100 miles from the northeast to the southwest, right across the, like a belt across Dane County. And so my guess is that you had so many individual thunderstorm and lightning events going on within that line, and they're not timed. They're not sequenced like a fireworks show. They're all kind of random. And so there's a rumble from each one of them,
and it just creates this cacophonous chorus of the rumbles at different frequencies, different volumes, and it just, it was amazing that it rolled forever.
And so we normally live on the north end of town, but we were visiting people on the south, southwest part of town, and so we didn't have that real crazy rain that some had it, but I kept checking the radar. There was lightning all over the place.
Yeah.
Lightning strikes everywhere.
There was a lot of it.
And that's just going to give you that thunder that's just not going to go away.
Yeah, not a no second of silence. Yeah, from that.
I'm with Fawn. I've never heard anything like it.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just sitting in the living room. I think I had the TV on, watching something, and it just kept going. And I thought, I wonder, can that really be?
Yeah,
continuous thunder?
Rolling thunder. I think that's what people refer to it as, kind of colloquially. It's rolling thunder.
Yeah.
It's a great word.
I got up and sat out on the porch a while, and I said, that's thunder.
Yeah.
And you didn't see much lightning. All you saw was the thunder. Well,
it could have been higher up in the cloud, not striking the ground, just going cloud to cloud.
Why, I mean, you'd get an occasional one maybe, but... Yeah. Mostly it was just that rumble, and I thought, God, is there a tornado coming, or what's,
Distant lightning strikes along that line are contributing to the sound, and you can't see the light. Just like the heat lightning, you hear about.
Oh, right, yeah.
You see the lightning, but it's so far away, and it's so isolated that the thunder has kind of gone away. Yeah. But if you got a whole collection of thunderstorms firing off at the same time, you hear a roll.
And, of course, if you hear thunder, then there is lightning. And going on your back porch to look at it is probably not the best safety. Just want to get that out there.
Good point.
Well, here we are. Through the end of May, we had 23 tornadoes. That's through the end of May.
Hmm. Yeah.
Not counting
now we're
six
up to 30,
we just
right?
had.
Yeah. At least 30. Yeah.
And 23 is the what we normally see in a year. Yeah. And this was a little piece in the Wisconsin State Journal.
Yeah.
Noted that this
morning. And I'll say this, too. I mean, really, the state maximum tends to be in July and early August, not in May and June. So we got a nearly record season already at what's approximately the beginning of the peak
season.
So,
right?
It's going to be a wild summer that way, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, even if nothing else happens, that would still be true.
And this started way back in February.
Yeah,
and we got
that's right.
our first tornado in February.
And that was in Dane County. It was in Belleville.
Yeah. Right.
So
that's right.
Not far away, not in some weird part of the state. Right here.
Yeah. Jack in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jack.
Hello there. I have a question relating to a program many months ago when the weathermen were on. They were speaking about, I believe he was the first head of the meteorology down in Madison, but he was also instrumental in World War II in helping to lay out the bombing runs, et cetera, because of I don't know if it was jet streams, et cetera. And I know they had mentioned there was a book out by on that individual, and I was just wondering who that was.
Is that Reed Bryson, maybe?
No, I think it's my book. I think he's talking about.
Oh,
I think it's your book.
Yeah, I wrote a biography of a scientist named Reginald Sutcliffe, and it was published a couple of years ago. And the name of the book is Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather System Science. And you can, Purdue University Press published it, and you can probably find it online by that title. Just write Reginald Sutcliffe, and it'll probably come up in your search box. But he played a big role in the English Air Force, well, Royal Air Force, in the bombing of Central Europe and trying to beat the Nazis. So he was a big forecaster at the time. He developed our science as a response to some of the things he learned in that setting.
And that was John Martin talking, by the way, J-O-N Martin.
Yeah.
M-A-R-T-I-N. If you put that in, too, John Martin, author, UW, it'll pop up.
Yeah.
It's a good book.
Yeah, it was a good book. And it's been probably 2 years since we actually talked about it. So, Jack, your memory's pretty good.
It is good.
Appreciate it. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Did get an email. Jill heard that there may be a derecho event tonight in southern Wisconsin in the areas where the tornadoes went through this weekend. And Jill's question is, what is a derecho and how does it form?
So a derecho is it's sort of much different than a tornado, although it's associated with severe weather. It's typically straight line winds, usually accompanied by heavy precipitation as well. I hadn't heard yet that the forecast was for a derecho. I did see that we're looking at some heavy precipitation early morning tomorrow, so the 3 a.m., 4 a.m. Time frame, heavy precip again, and some potential for severe weather.
Yeah, and I saw on a satellite picture today, just coming over, the sort of telltale sign you start to see, again, this is about 2 weeks early to mid-July, the so-called ring of fire, which is a continuous convection over the international falls boundary water area at the crest of a ridge that tends to form in the central United States. That spawns a lot of these derecho-type storms, these strong straight-line wind events. One of the most famous ones occurred June 24th, or what was it, 5 or 6 years ago? Remember that? The one that marched all the way across from Dane County to Maryland.
Yeah.
So they can be long-lasting. This one was a day and a half long going across all of that stretch. And so this is the time of year for them. And what they are is thunderstorms, as Steve said, severe storms are involved in them. So thunderstorms can not only make the air rise up and down within the column of the storm and, you know, produce precipitation, drop hailstones and whatnot, but it can also move air from different elevations from one spot to the next. And so sometimes these derechos, the air is mixed from the jet stream level right down to the ground. So you're bringing air that doesn't change its momentum from having a 70 meter per second horizontal wind speed right down to the ground. And it'll not really pay much attention to your barn or your house that happens to be in the way. It'll just blow it right over. And so there can be really substantial damage from these things, even though they're not tornadic.
Yeah. And the damage is very different from a tornado where it's just, you can still get total destruction, but everything's laid in one way.
In one direction.
One direction.
The wind is running straight, not
Yeah, that
spinning.
Went through an area where in the Shawamigan National Forest. Spent a lot of time. I've talked about that in the past. And seeing that from the air, we had aerial, a friend who was a pilot, so we flew over it.
Yeah, those blowdowns are.
Could just blow down the
all
the
trees
in the same direction.
In the same direction,
It's amazing power.
Yeah, amazing power. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin with us today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from UW-Madison. It's great to have them back, as always, on the last Monday of the month, which Steve reminded me, this is the earliest last Monday of any month you can get.
Yeah, right. This is right, the Monday before, right? Next Monday's the first.
Yeah. Oh, man. Dean in west of Denver, Colorado. Welcome to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, folks. I wanted to fill from last program. Thanks very much for having Coast Guard on. We take our sailboat up from Colorado to Wisconsin, to Bayfield, actually, Coast Guard station there. So shout out to you. Thanks for having them on. We really appreciate them. The other thing I was going to pass along, too, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the word normal and average with regard to weather. My master's advisor, Helmut Landsberg, would say, no, weather is always normal. It's whether it's above or below average is the significance.
Yeah, normal is a statistical term.
Yeah.
And we just tend to use it, not...
But you had a question for us too, Dean.
Yes, and so the question is, you know, this is another exceptionally warm year globally, and especially out here in Colorado. We're in the foothills, and it's 90. It's crazy. What are you guys, what's the latest on thinking of what's the cause for this another exceedingly warm year, and now with El Nino behind us, it's not a primary driver anymore.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the fundamental cause is we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that's a greenhouse gas that causes solar energy to pass through, essentially, and then the energy that we emit at the temperatures we have at the Earth's surface get absorbed, and that warms up the atmosphere. And then the down wind effects, if you will, maybe downwind's the wrong word to use in a meteorology show, but the secondary effects that then occur in terms of changing global patterns of the winds, changing the global temperatures of the oceans, which then also feed back to the atmospheric circulation patterns.
Yeah, and then there's local things, as Steve's pointing out, too, that if you start out the spring drier than average at a certain location, that's going to probably make it warmer than average at that location, and then that gets into a feedback effect. And it's funny how these things go. Every single spring that leads to summer has a different beginning trajectory, but if they're governed by processes that on the large scale are kind of encouraging warmth above average conditions, that's going to be really hard to shake off. And I think that's what we're starting to see summer after summer, that the encroachment of warming is really putting us in a statistical different space.
Yeah. No. Some of these heat waves we're having now on the East Coast, well, in the central U.S. as well, I mean, it's just crazy.
It is amazing. It's just amazing. Yep.
Dean, thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Lee in Madison next. Hi, Lee.
Hello. Quick question for you. With all this warm weather we've having in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, how do we get hail? Where does that come from? Is there a certain altitude that the air temperature is below 32 and it freezes from up there and comes down? How do we get hail in these hot days?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Lee. The temperature at the surface is not the same as the temperature at many elevations above the ground. In fact, the temperature on average drops about 6.5 degrees Celsius, which is on the order of 9 degrees Fahrenheit, for every 1,000 meters of increased ascent. And there are days where it even be more extreme than that. And so if you get about 5 kilometers, which is about 3 miles above the ground, even if the temperature is 80 degrees at the surface, you're going to be something like 30 degrees at that level. And so 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's not difficult with the deep clouds that you can get, the convective clouds in the summertime, for much of that cloud to be well above the point where the temperature is below freezing. And so there's ice all over those clouds. And so it's easy to make a hailstone if you've got temperatures cold enough. But you're exactly right. It's the temperatures above the ground that matter.
And you guys wrote in a column not that long ago that the largest known hailstone in Wisconsin fell in Wausau in 1921, and it measured 5.7 inches.
Mm. Yeah. And the way they get that big is, as John's explaining, you need to have those cold temperatures, of course. And it's the vertical circulations recycle that frozen particle. So the frozen particle will hit some liquid water, some rain, accumulate some, get pushed back up into the higher regions, refreeze. And then so it's that collection process. And the bigger they get, the more they circulated, or I guess that's part of it. The other part is how much water is in the cloud.
Yeah, but they're both related to how strong the updraft has to be.
Yeah.
You can't keep a giant, you know, softball-sized piece of ice up in the air unless you have a 60-meter-per-second updraft, about 100-mile-per-hour updraft.
Yeah,
and that's
there was
extreme.
A 7-inch one, 7-inch stone just observed in Texas.
Is that right?
7.4 or something like that. It's just...
it's just incredible. Like, yeah, that land.
And they're not
head.
Spherical, you know, now because of the way they... circle through the storm. They're often, those big ones are usually oblate, and they got, you know, bumps on the back where water would be liquid and then freeze when it got to the back of the stone as it's falling down.
So it's spiky.
It's spiky. Yeah.
There's stories of whole wedding parties in northern India, 1888, April 30th, 1888. A whole wedding party of 200 people was demolished by hailstones. And so if
killed?
Killed. Yeah. If they're that big, you can get killed by those things. Because they don't. It's not a lone hailstone. There's a whole collection of them coming at you.
Yeah.
It's horrible, frightening.
Yeah. Oh. Well, Lee, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Just amazing how big those things can get.
I know, it is.
That's severe weather.
Yeah,
that is. That is.
There's nothing else more severe.
Right. Oh, by the way, someone else was wondering, how fast are those derechos, those straight line winds, what kinds of speeds can those straight line winds get?
I think they can get over 100 miles per hour in extreme cases.
I mean, you're bringing down
the
jet stream, essentially.
Yeah. They can get well over 100 miles per hour.
Yeah.
I think when it gets to about 70 or more, the Weather Service calls it an extreme wind event. So there's a whole collection of wind speeds above that that would qualify as extreme, but are part of what can come from one of these derechos.
Yeah,
well over 100 miles per hour.
Mary Kay in Kenosha, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, I'd like to know if the pole shifting has anything to do with climate change.
The pole shifting.
So you mean the magnetic pole?
Yes.
Yeah. Boy, you know, it probably does in a small way. And what I'm thinking here is as climate changes and warms in particular, the ice caps, the mass in the ice caps is going to change. And that'll cause another slightly different wobble that might cause the magnetic field to change around.
Does that make sense?
But magnetic field responds to what's happening
right,
to the ice. Yeah, it's not the other way around. That's possible, isn't it?
Mary Kay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. On the other extreme, we've got wildfires in, I think we have 10 states right now, both on the east and the west coast.
That's another.
Well, I'll say two things about that. First of all, you never heard about East Coast wildfires in June, ever before. Okay, so that's new. And it happened last year. We had the big one in eastern Canada that gave us the smoky skies in late June for us. It was remarkable, the visibility reduction. And then even the West Coast wildfires are occurring earlier. I think anybody who's paid attention to these knows they're more like a July, August, or even fall phenomena. They peak in October. So to have this stuff happening in June at the level where it attracts national attention and does the damage it's doing is again, an evidence of an encroachment of something changing in the climate, and we kind of know what that is. I should also say one last thing. This was one of the forecasts made about 20 years ago. This will be one of the types of events that will become more common and will start earlier. And son of a gun, those forecasts were right.
Yeah.
No one's forecasting a delay to the fire season, a diminishment of the fire season. So, you know, the skeptics have to admit that. There's no predictions for that. It's the other way around.
Yeah. Will the, I mean, we're also seeing, it feels like, an increase in rain events.
This spring is a bad place to make that judgment, I think, because we've had only, we had the article today, one five-day period where it didn't rain since April 1. That's it.
Yeah.
In Madison, anyway. And that's, I don't know how unusual that is, but it seems unusual to me. So, I don't know about that. But I think globally people say more extreme individual rain events are occurring.
Yeah, I think the rain events are coming heavier.
Yeah,
or
maybe
the monthly is going to stay the same or nearly the same. It comes in fewer events, and therefore it's heavier rain.
And it can be more difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
So you're hoping for, you know, Eastern Canada would have loved to have some heavy rain events.
You bet. Yeah. You bet. They'd have loved it as right.
Before the fires. You don't want to have them after the fires.
Yeah.
No.
The soil's washed away.
But they take
away.
Them now because they got to get rid of the zombies, so-called zombie fires that are underground. They need some groundwater, I suppose.
Sehel in Hurley, we go to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like an opinion from your guests. I read a few years ago that one of the most desirable parts of the country to live in will be the upper Midwest, and that is because of the proximity to good water, as well as not experiencing the tragedies and extremes on both coasts. I wonder whether they would agree with that.
Well, since you asked for an opinion, and a lot of people are listening, maybe perhaps outside of the state, I'm going to say no way. This is, you know, stay where you are.
But on the other hand, I'd say if I were somehow to inherit a fortune and I was deciding to use that fortune to buy properties, I would buy them in the upper Midwest. Yes, for exactly that reason. This is going to be a climate island, I predict, in the next 25 to 50 years. Yep.
And it's been a wonderful place to live for the last 30. I mean, it's just a nice place. People are nice. The weather is nice. A lot of the activities to do. You get seasons.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which you don't get in Southern California.
And the Brewers are in first place.
Well, now you changed it.
almost July 1. I figured it was time to say that.
Seal, I think the answer to your question is yes. It will be the most desirable place to live in the United States, the northern Midwest, due to climate change, for sure. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You mentioned, somebody was wondering, you mentioned, was it heat domes? You were talking about fires, something or other.
Yeah, about the heat domes sitting over areas, which is not only hot, but dries them out as well.
So it's, how does that occur?
Heat dome is kind of a new invented word by the media. It's not a meteorological term, but the reason you get heat waves in the summertime has to do with the, a flow configuration called an anticyclone, or a ridge of high pressure at upper levels that tends to make the air sink very gently. But as it sinks, it warms up. It increases the stability of the stratification and makes it really difficult to mix anything out. So you can keep pollutants. You can keep warm air and various things trapped near the ground for extended periods of time, so long as those anticyclones last. And they do tend to last a good long time in the summertime, days on end. So you can get extended periods of stagnant conditions. You can't mix water vapor out of the air that might be trapped down there. It can stay humid, muggy, polluted. And that's what I think people in the press are calling heat domes.
Yeah. Got it.
And they're over a large area. It's not just a small community. It's many states at once.
Yeah. Dick in Cumberland, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. It's a, kind of a three-part request here. First of all, I'd like to have Steve comment on something I've seen posted on Facebook where they're talking about these solar fields, that they not only, you know, will collect solar radiation for electrical purposes, but then it reflects an awful lot of heat back up into the atmosphere. It's causing these upward winds, and there's speculation that may be causing some weather-related phenomena. Number two, you were talking about size of hail. This is anecdotal, but I used to officiate volleyball, and there was a tornado that went through Rice Lake about 20 years ago, and my partner had a business there. We finished the game. I came home, and I'm driving south on 63, and it started to hail. So I pulled over, and right in front of me, on the road was a piece of hail. I saw it coming down, so it had to be big. Wow. It looked like the size of a football.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not kidding. And then I stayed there for a couple of minutes, and I started lighting up a little bit, and I said, well, okay, I can go again. Again, on my side of the road, about 20 yards in front of my car, and I'm only going 25, 30 miles an hour because, I mean, it's really raining. And a second one came down, and I saw that one too, and I'm thinking, it's anecdotal, and I couldn't measure that because it's landing on the blacktop, but it just splattered.
Wow.
Thirdly, Steve, did you ever go to River Falls your freshman year?
No. I grew up on Long Island.
Okay, all right, because there was a fellow that I was pretty sure had your name, and I was on May Hall, and you would have been on May Hall, but that's... So that's off. So please comment on that solar radiation reflecting back from the solar fields that are out west, generally in those barren areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm trying to think now. Think back to that, because there are two things that come to my mind. One is, in terms of the impact, it probably would be local because the fields usually aren't that big in terms of how much of the aerial coverage they take up. They do a lot of planting underneath the solar fields. I know in Wisconsin, the university has a solar field down here, down by the PSL area. Mm. They put some out, and they put vegetation below it to try and keep things from cooling down. Because what those solar fields want to do is absorb that solar energy. And then that turns that into electricity or storage for electricity. Of course, you could also then have reflection that might go reflect energy back up. But I don't think that that's much because they're generally dark. Mm. And so I don't think they want to reflect solar energy. They want to absorb it to convert that energy into storage for electricity or heat. Actually, you also do warming that way as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know more about it than that, so I would think that's the same thing. They don't put a particularly shiny surface on those things.
No, right, yeah, because they want that energy.
So
does that sound familiar, Dick?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then just comment on the size of a hailstone that big. I mean, I saw what I saw, Steve. I was scared.
I can imagine being scared, yeah, because that hits your windshield. That's going through.
Yeah, and, you know, it's important to keep in mind that the biggest one ever is the biggest one that was ever recorded and brought to somebody do the recording. So there's probably been bigger ones, and I think you're one of the people who's seen one of the big ones.
Yeah, yeah. And unless you have an ice chest, there's no way that you're going to keep it from melting as you try to get an observation
exactly.
on what the real size is.
Yeah, let alone want to get out during one of those events and grab the thing and put it in an ice chest. I'd rather be inside a car.
Not a very good plan, unfortunately.
Yeah, because you're right. If you get one big one, there's more than one big one.
That's right. They're not usually solos.
Right, yeah.
Thank you, Dick. Appreciate it. Randy and Hayward, we'll go to you. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Larry. So I live in Hayward, the northwestern part of the state, and with climate change happening, I couldn't remember if I read this or heard it from someone that our part of the state is experiencing it more rapidly than other parts of the state. Is there any truth to that? Or if you could just speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
I suppose it's possible that in some dimension of some of the climate that you experience in Hayward, you might see some rapid changes that other people in the rest of the state don't see quite as rapidly. I'm thinking about lake effect snow. If it warms up, you know, consistently year after year, and the number of times that it's cold enough to produce lake effect snow diminishes, then the total you receive at Hayward, which is famously large, will probably shrink. And the percentage change from what you used to get to what you get now will be one of the biggest signals in the state, probably, that one could attribute to a change in the climate. So it might be something as specific as that. I would be surprised if it were comprehensive, that all kinds of climate variables in Hayward were changing faster than everywhere else in the state. But I wouldn't be surprised if the lake effect snow total stands out as one of those.
And it's a great cross-country ski area.
Yeah.
And so if it is getting less, you may be observing, you know, the season ending sooner than what it normally
would. Yeah, so that speaks to impacts. Yeah. The impacts could be huge for the region.
And
noticeable
that way. Right. Because all of a sudden
that's
you can't
go
skiing in May.
Yeah.
Randy, thank you. Another Hayward caller, an emailer from Hayward, Tom. He remembers talking the 70s of a coming ice age. And has that been negated by climate science? If so, what was the evidence for that?
That's an excellent question, and I have the same suspicion. That when I was a teenager and I'm delivering newspapers, and I was thinking, this is great. These winters are exciting, one after another, 76, 77, 78, in various parts of the northern and eastern United States. And I think that spawned a mostly media-based speculation about what's going on. Are we going to get colder than normal? Are we heading into an ice age? But I think at the same time, it really kind of kicked climate science into gear, because I don't believe there was very much of that going on in that before 1970, except in the sort of drawing giant global climate maps and stuff like that, that kind of science. And so ever since, no one's making predictions about ice ages anymore, because they know the evidence is in and it's going the other way. So that's curious, and it's within my own lifetime. That does not happen anymore.
And I remember them being talked about, because I was just entering college and in this field, and people were talking about Ice Age, but I don't remember why they were thinking.
It wasn't very scientific,
as I
recall.
Maybe it was just, a couple of cold winters in a row.
Yeah, it was Farmer's Almanac science sort of spun up into a little bit of a minor hysteria, because I don't think there was any scientific... You can look back now in the literature. There's no scientific papers in the early 70s saying, watch out, the climate's getting colder.
Yeah.
Nobody
and ice ages take a lot longer to develop.
Aaron in Oshkosh will give you a chance. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Thank you very much. If you don't mind, I'm going to address this notion of reflectivity and photovoltaic fields very simply by stating that photovoltaic fields are designed to absorb the radiation and turn it into electricity, and therefore actually reflect less radiated energy to the atmosphere than their equivalent size body of water, whether it be a murky pond or whatever. Number two, one thing that has been well documented is the thermal heat gain by parking lots and asphalt shingling roofing material in cities of a black color. That has been well documented. Number three, if you go to monoculture and industrial farming, corn as a crop releases roughly about 82% of the water that processes daily to the atmosphere. And subsequently, on the backside of a corn field of an industrial size, you will, on average, feel a 2-degree drop and an 80% rise in humidity as if you were at the seacoast. So in terms of man-made things which affect our environment, get rid of black asphalt parking lots, have all roofs be white, put up renewable energy, and stop industrial monoculture, and bam, there you go.
All right. I hadn't realized, I mean, I was familiar with all the other things you said, but I hadn't realized that the reflectivity is less than what you see over water.
Yeah, neither did I. That's interesting. Yeah,
very interesting. Aaron, thank you so much. You know, there are things, we have done things as a world to, we've been able to get together. I'm trying to think back to fluorocarbons.
Oh, yeah, the Montreal Protocol, 1987.
It
got the world together, and we eliminated them, and we've saved 1 degree.
Yeah.
And lots of money. I mean, industry doesn't spend money on fluorocarbons anymore. They found cheaper alternatives that don't hurt the environment.
Yeah.
The business people are smart. You know, they're not dumb. You give them a challenge, they'll figure it out. Yeah. Why can't we just accept the challenge? We used to do that. We need to do it again.
Mitch in Green Bay, we'll get to you in just a second. Just a quick reminder, our guest today, Steve Ackerman, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and John Martin Professor, former Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest today. Great to have them with us. Our weather guys here on WPR News. We're talking weather and climate today with our weather guys. Great to have you along. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Mitch in Green Bay, we go to you. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. I was wondering if in China and Mongolia and all the way back through Russia and into Europe, do they all have this same kind of weather problems that we are having, or don't they have this kind of extremes of, with the fires and everything?
Well, they're certainly having similar problems in the sense that the global warming is global, and so they're seeing those impacts as well. They don't generally get tornadoes, so I don't think they're getting that kind of severe weather changes that we're seeing, or a number of hailstorms. Oh, they get, do get big hail, I should say.
Yeah.
Take that back.
In Mongolia and northwestern China are dry every spring and summer, and so big dust storms can develop there. And so they have problems with precipitation that are interannually variable. I don't know what this year is like for them this year, but you know, from time to time they get some serious droughts. And the same is true in Russia. And then there's a huge forested area of northern Russia that's hardly populated. So there's bound to be wildfires that occur in parts of northern and central Russia that don't even get reported because there's so much distance between people who, you know, might populate any of those areas. So I think it's a global phenomenon.
And speaking of dust storms, there was just a big dust storm that I think it originated in Mexico and then came up into Arizona. I saw some of these fantastic. I think it's fantastic because I've been in a dust storm.
Yeah.
Not pleasant, but it was amazing photos of this big dust outbreak coming right up into, I forget what the city was in Arizona.
But, Tucson or?
I don't think it was Tucson. No, I don't reckon. It wasn't one of the big ones. It wasn't Phoenix, I don't think.
Oh, you like that.
But yeah, it's really... It's amazing. And part of that, again, is, I mean, they always have dust storms down in that area. It's just the frequency going up.
Yeah, and these are places that don't get much annual precipitation. So if there's even the slightest decrease in from normal, you're going to have more dust.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
I can remember driving across Arizona more than once and seeing these little tornadoes.
Dust devils.
Yeah. And some of them were pretty good size.
Yeah. I had a roommate in college in graduate school who drove down to Nevada on the weekends from Seattle just to see the hay devils, you know, and the dust devils in the plains of Nevada.
And I heard somebody had gotten hyperthermia from that.
Really?
So it won't destroy things because they're not going that strong. But I guess there can be a big temperature drop in the middle of it if you get inside
it. That's pretty cool. Because of the dramatic lowering of pressure.
Because of the dramatic lower pressure.
Wow.
Right.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Mitch, thanks again. Lee in Minocqua, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Larry, so much for having me on. First of all, I listen to your show. I've listened for a very long time. I refer so many people, especially since I work in a nursery. I refer so many people to your Garden Talk show. So I really appreciate that. I have to preface this in saying that I was a skeptic of global warming or man-made global warming. And I still am very much. We know it's gone on forever. But what I told your caller was that I just wanted to say that, one of your guests kind of referred to that back in the 70s, the
the Ice Age?
The narrative about the coming Ice Age, he kind of suggested that it was media-driven. But you know what? I was in college in the 70s, and our college or our science department, they had a class, because I was very, I was really into this, but they had a class called Man and His Environment. And I took that class, and their big thing that I took away from that class was that there was a coming ice age. So, and that was apparently the current science or how it was being read. And so I'm just very skeptic about our interpretations now. But one other thing, I wish you would. I mean, there are very credible people who disagree with your guests, and I wish, because you're having these guys on, that you would have somebody on with the other point of view, seeming it is public radio. But again, I appreciate your show so much. I'll listen off the air.
This is the old equal time thing, and there are many issues on which equal time is an excellent idea. No one is publishing papers and getting them reviewed blindly by colleagues anymore, and it didn't happen in the 70s, where people were predicting with scientific reason that there was an ice age coming. No one's doing that now. And the reason why is because it's not true. And so, I'm glad that we have a chance to have this conversation. You mentioned at the beginning of your comment that climate change has been going on forever. And you used the phrase man-made climate change has been going on forever. No, it has not been going on forever because human beings have not been here forever. The climate on Earth has changed over and over, and we see that in other records. But what we've seen in the last 300, 400 years, especially the last 200 of those 400 years, is an unprecedented increase in the carbon dioxide fraction, unequaled ever before in the history of the planet. That is not divorced from our activity. The consequences of that increase are also undivorceable from our activity. So it is nonsensical to suggest that there's equal opinions on this issue. Sorry, there aren't.
And I obviously totally agree with John, and also would just point out that, there are two things. When they all align, it's just hard to refute. One is the data. The data all show something, and the physics that goes along with that data all agree. And then the interdependencies are also aligned. And so it's hard to believe that,
it's not by accident, not coincidence.
Yeah.
Rich in Elkhart Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you. I wonder if you explain something to me. I'm wondering how they measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Is it by actual weight? And let me say that, let's say you have a 10-pound block of wood and you burn it. Does that mean there are then 10 pounds
of the carbon dioxide molecule now floating in the atmosphere? Or how is the amount, I mean, they talk, there's billions of tons of CO2 in the air. Is that, if they put it on a scale, all the CO2 molecules, it would add up to, you know, a billion tons or whatever that number is.
Yeah.
Could you please explain that to me?
Yeah, I'm not a chemist, so I can't tell you exactly how one would technically and logistically make those measurements. But every one of the elements, and they're the compounds that are made of the elements, has an atomic weight. And you can take a bag full of air and bring it to a lab and figure out what the constituent components of that bag are. Carbon dioxide is a small fraction of any bag of air you take at sea level or anywhere in the atmosphere. It's well mixed up to 80 kilometers, but it's really a small fraction. But nonetheless, that fraction can be determined in a laboratory with sophisticated equipment, of which I'm not an expert. The same can be done with bubbles of air that are trapped in ice that are mined from, you know, the high latitudes, either in the North Pole, but more regularly at the South Pole. And you can get ice that's 400,000, 500,000 years old. And it trapped air on the day it froze with a composition that characterized the air around the globe 500,000 years ago. You can bring that to the same lab and figure out whether or not the carbon dioxide fraction in that bubble is smaller or greater than the air that's outside your window today. And that's how we can make those statements about what's happened to the carbon dioxide fraction. And I don't know an answer because, again, I'm not a chemist, about what happens when you oxidize a piece of wood, but certainly not all 10 pounds of it becomes carbon dioxide. That couldn't be the case. There's other particulates that get released from that fire, and they have mass as well. So it won't be just all carbon dioxide.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Rich. Appreciate it. Mike in St. Lawrence wonders where the heat dome is in the atmosphere. Is it located in relation to where hail is forming?
Usually not. The conditions that produce what's been called a heat dome by the press are kind of almost exactly the opposite of the kind of conditions you need for the formation of thunderstorms and rain and the potential for a hailstorm. So I think most of the time they're going to be almost exclusive. There may be boundaries between one type of weather and another in which thunderstorms may develop, and so there might be a little bit of overlap. But most of the time they'd be exclusive to each other.
And Marilyn emailed to ask if an active sunstorm, if active sunstorm seasons have effect on the weather.
They certainly affect the upper atmospheric weather. And we see that through things like the aurora borealis. I mean, there were some good times this spring where, again, the active sun, the solar flares happen to come towards Earth and then interact with the upper atmosphere. So if you think of the upper atmosphere as having weather in things like aurora borealis or their counterpart in the southern hemisphere, then, yeah, it does.
Yeah, and but maybe weather doesn't mean the same thing as it does more colloquially, right, like raining, yeah, or not, you, yeah, know, stuff like that.
And Tony emailed to say a couple of months ago we set records in the Madison area with temperatures 40 degrees above daily average temperatures.
40 degrees above the average? I can't recall a time we were 40 degrees above,
yeah,
the average.
Yeah,
that's a little bit off.
Yeah, it may have been a typo in the translation here. Yeah. Mm. What would the temperature be if this occurred in the hottest days of summer? In Mexico in the past week, Tony heard they set a new all-time high of 125 degrees Fahrenheit.
I was going to guess 124.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
Because I don't think I've ever heard of, well, I'm going to take that back, because probably the Sahara Desert probably gets above into the 130.
Someplace in Libya used to have the maximum record 134.6 or something like that. But I don't know if that's actually right.
I mean, 125 is just...
Yeah. Who cares? What's 10 degrees among friends?
Right.
When you're at 125 degrees, that's not a good place to be.
Yeah. No, it definitely is not. Yeah. And we're not in a good place to be because we've got lots of callers and lots of emails, but we're out of time. Thank you guys very much.
Well, we're coming back.
Yeah, we'll be back.
We'll be back and we'll take this all up again. Thank you so much for being with us today. And don't forget, we got this is a team effort here. Our producers, by the way, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio News.